Where does Washington fit into the CETA agreement, which is supposedly a free trade agreement between Canada and the European Union? How does CETA intersect with NAFTA to generate a NAFTA-EU economic alliance under corporate rule? Does the CETA agreement violate the Canadian Constitution? How could an agreement on trade and investment interfere with the operations of Canada's central bank and the way the country finances public interest enterprises? How would monopolies and crown corporations in Canada be affected by this deal? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we explore the ramifications of the latest major international trade deal known as CETA, the Canada-EU Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, which is feverishly being pursued in the face of high-profile resistance from citizens in Europe and Canada, and until recently, from one small district in Belgium. We'll hear opinions from constitutional lawyer Rocco Galati and former parliamentarian and political activist Paul Hellyer, who tabled a constitutional challenge of CETA. We'll also hear from Professor Michel Chossadovsky, who argues that CETA is a proxy for NAFTA-EU integration. On this week's program, Stop CETA, analysis from Michel Chossadovsky, Rocco Galati's constitutional challenge. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 28th, 2016. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. NATO's show of force is largely in response to Moscow's decision to dispatch warships to Russia's Tartus naval base on Syria's eastern Mediterranean coastline. The propaganda ploy led by Britain's tabloids point to quote-unquote Russian aggression in Syria following the dispatch of the Kuznetsov aircraft carrier from the Baltic Sea to Syria's eastern Mediterranean coastline. President Putin sent a fleet of 8 Russian warships through the English Channel to assist the assault on the besieged Syrian city, says the Daily Mail. What the report fails to mention is that parts of Aleppo are in the hands of Al-Qaeda terrorists who are supported and financed by U.S., NATO, and its Middle East allies. Russia's naval deployment is largely motivated by Washington's stated intent to establish a no-fly zone over Syria, which could lead to direct military confrontation between U.S., NATO, and Syria and Russia. That comes from the article, "The Russians Are Coming. War Propaganda Goes into High Gear, Renewed NATO Military Deployments on Russia's Doorstep," by Professor Michel Chossadovsky, posted October 27th. Russia has made it clear that they will not tolerate another Iraq in Syria. They will support the Assad regime and not allow the U.S. to overthrow yet another Middle Eastern government. Russia insists the U.S. is intentionally trying to promote anarchy in Syria by destroying the country, maintaining brutal sanctions that only harm innocents, and giving quote-unquote moderates heavy weapons to help bring down Assad. Russia has drawn a line in the sand, and Ms. Clinton is showing a severe lack of judgment in provoking and blaming them for all that ails the world. She has even compared Putin to Hitler, which historically is tantamount to declaring war. That comes from the article, "Hillary Clinton is Playing with Thermonuclear Fire and You Will Be Glowing," by Joe Clifford, posted October 26th. The most liberal presidential candidate still running, Green Party candidate Jill Stein, says, quote, "It should be clear to everyone that a vote for Hillary Clinton is a vote for war. Under Hillary Clinton, we could very quickly slide into nuclear war with her declared policy on Syria. I call for a peace offensive," unquote. And it's interesting indeed that the neocons who got us into the Iraq War have endorsed Clinton instead of Trump. That comes from the article Fact Check. Trump is right that Clinton might trigger World War III by Washington's blog, posted October 27th. Stopping the U.S. war on Syria requires that U.S. activists actively educate and focus on the U.S. role so that people can be agitated into action and mobilized by the tens of thousands. The principal pox on both houses approach leads in practice to inaction, making it an empty phrase when what is needed is a concrete strategy for effective on-the-ground organizing. The essence of a revolutionary internationalist approach to anti-war strategy was summarized by Leon Trotsky when he said, quote, "In the struggle against imperialism and war, the basic principle is the chief enemy is in your own country," unquote. The quote is a guide to action for those living in imperialist countries, and the U.S. remains the world's foremost imperialist country. That comes from the article Military Escalation in the Wake of the U.S. Presidential Elections, Stopping Hillary's Coming War on Syria, by Seamus Cook, posted October 27th. The first shadow government, referred to as COG, or Continuity of Government, is made up of unelected individuals who have been appointed to run the government in the event of a catastrophe. When and if COG takes over, the police state will transition to martial law. Yet it is the second shadow government, also referred to as the deep state, that poses the greater threat to freedom right now. Comprised of unelected government bureaucrats, corporations, contractors, paper pushers, and button pushers who are actually calling the shots behind the scenes, this government within a government is the real reason we, the people, have no real control over our government. The deep state, which operates according to its own compass heading, regardless of who is formally in power, makes a mockery of elections and the entire concept of a representative government. That comes from the article, The Path to Total Dictatorship, America's Shadow Government and Its Silent Coup, by John W. Whitehead, posted October 26th, originally appearing at the Rutherford Institute. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. There's one aspect of the Canada-European Union Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement that's seldom examined, even by critics, and that is how CETA interfaces with NAFTA. Professor Michel Chalcedovsky, Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa and the founder and director of the Centre for Research on Globalization, argues that the two agreements work together to form a de facto NAFTA-EU Atlantic Economic Trading Bloc with severe ramifications for the citizens of the member countries. To explain this point further, Professor Chalcedovsky joins us now from Montreal. Good morning, Professor Chalcedovsky.
Yes, good morning.
So, International Trade Minister Chrystia Freeland has spoken of the agreement between Canada and the EU as a contract between like-minded societies embracing liberal or social democratic values. So it would come as a surprise to many that this is an initiative directed from Washington. Could you explain exactly how the U.S. is involved and active behind the scenes?
Well, first of all, we have to address the broader scenario of the trade agreements which are being negotiated. With regard to North America, there were three bilateral projects with the European Union, respectively by Mexico, the United States, and Canada. The main trade agreement was a TTIP, in other words, bilateral relationship between the United States and the European Union, which was, of course, the object of controversy and ultimately is stalled. When we look at the CETA agreement, in other words, the Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement between Canada and the Canada and the European Union, we have to understand that Canada and the United States are integrated into a North American free trade area, NAFTA, which has extensive clauses with regard to trade and investment, intellectual property rights, financial services, etc., and that a bilateral agreement between Canada and the European Union will eventually trigger the integration of NAFTA and the European Union from the trade and investment point of view, but very broadly, even politically, leading to what I would call the North Atlantic Trade and Investment Area, NATIA. That concept is not official, but that's what I would describe it as being, a trading bloc broadly coinciding, and that's very important, with the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And mind you, the Asian component, the Asia-Pacific component, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, has also a similar logic. It's the integration of Atlantic, it's the integration of Pacific nations and Southeast Asian countries within the realm of not only a trade and investment framework, but it's also a geopolitical and strategic alignment, ultimately also directed against China. And as we know, that China has put forth this concept of One Belt, One Road, which is the Eurasian project. So that you have essentially two major trading blocks, which are an initiative of Washington. It's an imperial project, which broadly coincide with the structure of military alliances, and which, from the outset, exclude both the Russian Federation, the Middle East, Iran, and of course, China. So that's the geopolitical context. But what I'm saying with regard to Canada-EU relations is that this, in essence, is not a bilateral agreement. You've got 28 countries on the one hand, the European Union, and then you've got one country on the other, and not a major country, Canada, 36 million people. Okay, it's a backdoor mechanism. In other words, I consider that the CETA agreement presented to public opinion as an innocuous bilateral EU-Canada trade deal constitutes a TTIP in disguise. And that what it means is it has all the major clauses of the trade agreements, going back to the WTO. Commodity trade in services, investment, intellectual property, financial services, and then, of course, legal provisions which allow corporations to overshadow the sovereignty of national governments, and so on and so forth. And it is impossible for Canada to enter into a bilateral agreement without it ultimately leading to a subsequent stage, which is the integration of the United States with the European Union to form that project. The project is a trading bloc. It's the Atlantic Trading Bloc. And the strategy was to implement that trading bloc through bilateral agreements rather than a full-fledged agreement, which would be NAFTA, European Union, which politically would not have been accepted by the member states of the European Union.
Is it possible you could give us a like kind of a concrete illustration of what you're talking about? Like, say, there's a European community, district, or whatever. Where how would the U.S. presumably be involved in terms of undermining what's happening there?
Well, I think to answer that question, you have to go back to the Bush versus, it was essentially, it was during the Harper period, during the Conservative government in Canada, that these things were put together, okay? And it's part of foreign policy broadly. No, it's an economic project, but it's part of U.S., Canada foreign policy. And during the Harper the Harper government, we had very much a copy and paste with regard to broad initiatives of this nature. And I don't have the record. We may have to go back and look at the historical record as to how it was decided by the member states of the North American Free Trade Area, namely the United States, Canada, and Mexico, that they decided to have to implement these three bilateral initiatives. And eventually these three bilateral initiatives would merge, and there we get, we reach the final objective, which is the imperial project of creating a North Atlantic trading bloc, dollarized, of course. It eventually will lead to the dollarization of that bloc and the European monetary system, which is already, ultimately, is already dollarized. The Eurozone would merge with the dollar zone. And then I pointed to the fact that we would really be integrating countries which belong to the same military alliance, which is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
So I know that the United Kingdom has apparently voted for Brexit, so they're they seem to be moving out of the European Union, and yet, I mean, you talk about this convergence with NATO. I'm wondering what the UK's Brexit referendum would mean if that is the case. I mean, does that frustrate things or the planning in any way?
Well,
or how does the European Union respond in the face of that kind of that disconnect?
Well, you know, if we look at it in broader terms, historically there is an Anglo-American alliance, which has existed, it has existed since World War II. In fact, it has existed for much longer than that. I would say probably going back to the late 19th century with the foundation of the Council of Foreign Relations and so on. But that axis, that Anglo-American axis, is still there. And it's if there's going to be a North Atlantic trade and investment area, the Anglo-American axis would ultimately be dominant. I mean, the UK is very much also, let's say, the UK government has its sovereignty, but it's very closely aligned with the United States with regard to foreign policy with regard to economic issues. The defense industry, British Aerospace, is part of the Anglo-American defense contractors. It's registered in the United States. And weapons trade is, of course, very, very important. Okay, we see it. It's part of the both the strategic landscape and the economic landscape. We see Britain selling to Saudi Arabia. Canada is also selling weapons, but inevitably they are by companies which are in fact ultimately North American, because it's a Canadian counterpart of a U.S. Weapons producer. So again, I see the Anglo-American axis as being the dominant partner within a broader North Atlantic structure, and they are also dominant within NATO. Mm. Ultimately, they're a very powerful voice in NATO, and that powerful voice in NATO is ultimately also in liaison with Washington.
There's been a lot of convergence within Canada, the United States, and Mexico on energy policy and regulations and defense and economically. And so I'm wondering, with this, should the Canada-EU Comprehensive Economic Trade Agreement successfully go through, what does that do to just within North America? Does it enhance the existing alignments, and how exactly?
Well, I think those alignments are ongoing. I certainly would see that if, let's say, the European Union is integrated into a North Atlantic trading bloc, that structures of governance, let's say, let's use the term governance, is a very sort of popular term. The structures of governance would evolve, you would possibly have four centers of power: Brussels, Ottawa, Mexico, and Washington. With Washington acting as the highest level of governance in that political, economic, and strategic structure. Okay. With NATO and the North Atlantic Trade and Investment Area, etc. So I think that we'd have certain levels of governance. And then the other tendency, which has been ongoing, I would say, since the mid-90s, is what I'd call, and I use those terms, at that time, the North American states and provinces. It's the United States
and provinces.
And provinces of North America. The United States and provinces of North America. So it's a North American structure where you have provinces and you have states, and ultimately, it leads to what some people have called Fortress North America. That process is ongoing, and it's ongoing very gradually. You can see it in terms of defense agreements, the fact that Canada was ultimately, under the Liberal government of Jean Chrétien, they refused to join Northern Command. Okay, Northern Command was set up by Rumsfeld just immediately after 9/11, and it encroached on Canadian sovereignty, because Rumsfeld said Northern Command will its jurisdiction extends from the Caribbean up to the Northern Territories. Okay, and nobody actually contested it, but the Liberal government said, no, we're not going to join that. And then they created sort of a transition body, which was not part of Northern Command, but which was Canadian, and which interfaced with Northern Command. And now, de facto, we're members of Northern Command, and we have joint command structures, Canada-US. And in the area, in the spheres of economics and trade, the same thing with regard to corporate structures. And we see our financial institutions, let's say TD Canada Trust is the seventh largest, I think it's among the 10 largest financial institutions in the United States. Okay, we still have we still have our sovereignty in terms of banking, and that's a very important issue, Canadian banks. We don't have foreign banks coming into the landscape. But that, I think that is going to evolve. And so we are, in fact, moving towards a structure which we might describe as the United States and provinces of North America. And you can see it even when you go online and you order something online, and it says states, provinces, all the same, you know, and then you click as if, you know, we are really part of that appendage. So I would say we're going to have different levels of governance. Brussels, Ottawa, Washington, Mexico City, and beneath that we'll have the member states of the European Union, and we will have the governments of the provinces and the states in North America, and that is that's the hierarchy. And then eventually all those political entities are then subsequently then members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Mm-hmm. So that's the way I mean, that's the way I see that evolving. It's already happening.
Could I get maybe, because we're running a little bit out of time, I was wondering if you could maybe just give us a quick opinion, because I know you're arguably one of the world's foremost authorities on globalization, and I'm wondering where CETA fits into that larger trajectory of neoliberal globalization that we've seen over the last few decades.
Well, the thing is that the clauses in CETA are very similar to the clauses in all the other trade agreements. Okay, there's a certain pattern with regard, essentially, to trade. Well, trade is not the major issue. Investment, national treatment, intellectual property, the legal apparatus, and so on and so forth. You have that kind of architecture in all these trade agreements, and in a sense, they are built on the structures, or they extend the structures of the World Trade Organization. And I should say that the World Trade Organization is an illegal entity because it was never ratified by the parliaments, and that people forget that. Up to this date, it's still an illegal entity. Now, what I'm saying with regard to the movement against CETA. I think the movement against CETA has to be also formulated in a much broader framework. It's also a movement against imperialism, against an imperial project, and it should be understood that CETA eventually leads to the integration of NAFTA and the European Union. And that, of course, that's maybe much more important for the Europeans, because they don't realize ultimately that that's what's going to happen. It's not a relationship between the European Union and a country of 36 million people. Okay, it eventually leads to the integration of these two major trading blocks. Mm.
Well, Professor Chossudovsky, I'm afraid we have to leave it there, but thanks as always for your thoughts and analysis on these extremely concerning developments.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be on the program.
We've been speaking with Professor Michel Chossudovsky. He is the founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization and Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa. And you can find his commentaries at globalresearch.ca. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. The Canada-European Union Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, CETA, has, as this program goes to air, cleared the various roadblocks with hesitant EU countries, including most recently Belgium, and is now on a path to ratification within days, or so we are led to believe if we follow the mainstream media in Canada. On Friday, October 21st, Canadian constitutional lawyer Rocco Galotti filed a statement of claim against Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and the Government of Canada, arguing that the CETA violates and undermines the Canadian Constitution. Galati, along with Anne Emmett and the Honorable Paul Hellyer, the clients on whose behalf he is filing the claim, appeared at a press conference on Tuesday, October 25th, to explain the substance of the claim. Global Research participated in the conference by phone. The following is some of the audio from that press conference.
Rocco Galati, to my left is the Honorable Paul Hellyer, and to his left, Anne Emmett. We're here today to announce the filing of a constitutional challenge on last Friday, October the 21st, against the CETA, the trade accord with between Canada and the European Union. The challenge is based on four major prongs, and that is that first, that the federal executive does not have the constitutional authority to unilaterally bind the country without the treaty going through Parliament first and being enacted. And even if it were enacted through Parliament, even Parliament cannot encroach on exclusive provincial rights and other constitutional rights that are not the exclusive purview of the federal parliament. The second challenge is that the majority of the terms of the CETA actually encroach on exclusive provincial rights such as natural resources, education, health, property and civil rights, the licensing of professionals, the qualifications of professionals. Those are all exclusive provincial jurisdiction, and this treaty, in its opening chapter, in Chapter 2, the executive undertakes to make sure that all levels of government, including the provinces and the municipalities, comply with the treaty, which, of course, the federal executive nor federal parliament have the constitutional jurisdiction to do. Thirdly, what the treaty does is set up a foreign tribunal to adjudicate disputes between private corporations and the Government of Canada when private corporations cannot engage in the business they want to engage in because a province or other entity which has exclusive jurisdiction over the matter says no. Then we as Canadians have to compensate that company. So what that does in effect is It eliminates the pivotal lever of what maintains our constitutional democracy, and that's a fair and independent judiciary. So what we have is we have a tribunal that's going to sit in Ottawa when the dispute is heard, deciding issues of Canadian property, Canadian rights, and Canadian constitutional rights, but is beyond the reach or judicial review of Canadian courts. And lastly, what the CETA provisions do is eliminate subsidies, monopolies, and state enterprises that are there for the benefit of maintaining social welfare and economic programs for public welfare. And basically, this treaty, virtually all of it, covers every single social program. The only three exceptions in the treaty are national security, taxation, and cultural industries. So everything else is up for grabs for private exploitation by foreign corporations, overriding the Constitution of Canada and overriding the rights and of Canadian citizens who are resident here. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Hellyer before answering any questions.
Title of this little 5-minute expose I have is entitled Why I Am 100% Opposed to CETA. And I guess for this, in one line, it would be to save the Prime Minister from making the biggest mistake that any Prime Minister has made in the 67 years since I first set foot in Ottawa. But then to refine that a little bit, there are two profound reasons for opposing the ratification of CETA. First, it would be illegal. It would result in a unilateral change in the Constitution of Canada. And that is outside the power of both the government and Parliament. The second reason is that to ratify CETA would be monstrously immoral. It would be the biggest betrayal of Canadian rights and privileges in the history of the country. Not only would it give foreign banks and corporations greater rights in Canada than those enjoyed by Canadian citizens, which is indescribably wrong, in my opinion, it would give foreign bankers an effective veto over use of our most valuable financial asset, the Bank of Canada, at the very moment when we need it most. The situation today is reminiscent of the 1930s. In 1938, there were no jobs in Canada. None. Then the war came along, and pretty soon everybody was working, either in the armed forces or building factories or making munitions. And you say, where did the government get the money to accelerate growth to this extent, to do these things? The answer is that the Bank of Canada printed it. P-R-I-N-T-E-D, it. The money creation function was shared between the government of Canada and the private banks. This system was maintained after the war and helped pay for our large infrastructure projects. The St. Lawrence Seaway, the Trans-Canada Highway, the distant early warning line, some of you may not remember, but there was line of radar stations built all around the periphery of the continent, very expensive, and the Bank of Canada helped the government of Canada to pay for that installation, as well as to help us pay for a very comprehensive and much admired social security system. All of this was accomplished without significant borrowing and with inflation in line with other OECD countries. Then in 1974, the governor of the Bank of Canada abandoned the needs of his shareholders and started taking his orders from the Bank for International Settlements that is controlled by the elite international banking cartel. The result for Canada is that because we had to then borrow in the market from fiscal year 74-75 to 2013-14, we had to pay $1.17 trillion, that's trillion dollars, in interest on debt, almost all of it unnecessary. All of that, plus decades of underfunding for all of our essential services. We switched from prosperity to austerity, and the international banking cartel ended up with a monopoly over money creation. Well, all of this has to be reversed. The Canadian government gives the Parliament of Ottawa the absolute right to create or to have the Bank of Canada create all of the money necessary to meet the legitimate needs of the Canadian people. And as an aside, we need an infrastructure bank. Canada needs an infrastructure bank like it needs a hole in the head. We don't need it because we have one. And it worked from 39 to 74, 35 years. It worked like a charm, gave us the best 35 years of the century. And all we have to do is learn from history and do something similar again. Well, in fact, there is a plan called a social contract between the government and people of Canada, which is available to Parliament now. And this plan calls for the creation of $150 billion a year for 7 years to be split between Ottawa and the provinces and territories on a per capita basis. But if CETA were ratified and implemented, prosperity would never be restored, nor the backlog of needs met, because European banks would sue Canada for tens or hundreds of billions of dollars if we denied them the opportunity to lend us the money and buy up our real assets for 5 cents on the dollar and keep us in poverty forever. The war between the rich and the poor that the rich have been winning would be over. So CETA must not only wither on the vine, but die on the vine and become nothing more than a footnote to history.
A single article about the filing of the constitutional challenge appeared in the media courtesy of a report by Canadian Press. The Canadian Press article quoted a constitutional law expert from the University of Ottawa, Errol Mendes, as saying that Galati was mistaken about the claim that the federal government cannot sign and ratify trade deals without parliamentary consent, saying, quote, "It's basic 101 constitutional law that the federal government has the right to sign and ratify international treaties under the royal prerogative," Galati responded.
The fact of the matter is that prior to the Harper government engaging in negotiations on the CETA, the Parliamentary Research Library was asked to do a paper on the source of the constitutional authority for signing treaties, of which I have a copy, because this is the third time I've raised this issue in the court since 1998, and the first two times it did not get resolved by the courts to its conclusion. What that research paper from Parliament, which was floated to the government, states is that this whole notion of constitutional authority to sign treaties by the executive is in flux, and they stand on the old pre-patriation notion of residual crown prerogative back in the days when Westminster in England, the executive, Her Majesty the Queen, used to sign these treaties on behalf of all the dominions. That evolved in 1935 to allowing the Governor General as her designee here in Canada to sign on behalf of Canada. What's happened in my view, and with all due respect to Professor Mendes, who's probably never thought about it, is that the patriation of the Constitution extinguishes residual crown prerogative, which is the power in the Queen to exercise power that Parliament or the Constitution has not taken over. The House of Lords in England has made it clear that Her Majesty the Queen has no more role in Canada. So in 1998, in a case called Fogel that went to the federal court where the same issue was being litigated, the government moved to strike the claim based on the fact that this was a frivolous argument, this idea that the executive didn't have the right to sign international treaties. The court refused to strike it on that basis, and in the written judgment said, whether or not Crown prerogative still exists after the patriation of the Constitution in 1982 is a serious question to be resolved. The court didn't hear the case because in the context of multilateral agreement on investment, which was the case, the agreement was not ultimately signed by the Canadian government nor the other 28 OECD countries, and therefore the case, the court decided they weren't going to hear it because there was no treaty. However, on the issue that we're putting before the court, the federal court has already decided that this old notion of whether or not Crown prerogative exists to give the executive the authority to bind Canada this way is a serious question to be determined by the court. Now, is there a guarantee we'll win? No, but I stand firm on the representation that we're on solid legal ground here. You cannot have the executive knowingly sign away provincial rights with respect to provincial programs and provincial property in Canada and have a foreign body come to Canada and decide the rights of the province and of Canadian citizens domestically, including constitutional issues, and not have our courts have a say in it. I mean, how ludicrous is that?
And if I might add, the same argument applies to federal rights, including the unlimited jurisdiction of the Parliament of Canada over money and banking, which would be compromised by the treaty and would be in effect rendered ineffective, so that we couldn't use an asset which is our most precious financial asset in the whole country.
What CETA does through the back door is it allows foreign banks and insurance companies the right to say, well, Bank of Canada can't have any more say in the private banking industry because that infringes our treaty rights to compete with private banks. And so here you have a public institution, a public bank, set up by an act of parliament that has to take a back seat to the treaty rights of private corporations. It's completely ludicrous. Listen, just to draw you an analogy, what's happening here is that if you think about the irony that we patriated our Constitution in 1982, what this treaty does, and any treaty of this magnitude does, is literally revert us back to the rule of divine rule of kings. The only exception is they're not on thrones now. They're in a numbered company that floats around the universe and around the planet. And every government and every constitution has to take a back seat to these corporations. And they affect this not through democratic process in Canada, at any rate, by passing it through Parliament and consulting citizens and seeing if it's constitutionally permissible, but they simply do it by executive fiat. They get together in private and in secret for 8 years. They present a text. This is the main text of the CETA right here. If I had printed the annexes with all the products and details, it would be 7-8 times as high. And so we get this, and they say, we're signing it, and now the country and the Constitution and the Canadian citizens are bound just by executive fiat. Well, it's not an exaggeration to say, in another time and place, that's the same as saying, l'état c'est moi. You know, the Prime Minister saying, I am the state.
I'd like to put a question to you about further on this point about Crown prerogative. Now, if you're talking about the fact that the Prime Minister cannot invoke the Crown or royal prerogative in signing treaties, that has implications not just for CETA, it seems to me, but for every trade agreement that's been signed by Harper over the last, or for that matter, even NAFTA.
Well, to the extent that Parliament didn't later ratify through an act of Parliament, yes. But to answer your question, if Parliament has ratified it, the courts may say, well, that cured the problem. However, when you look at the terms of NAFTA, they still suffer from the same unconstitutional provisions that Mr. Hellyer and I have been talking about, and that is they encroach on provincial rights, the judicial mechanism for determining Canadian rights on Canadian soil under the Canadian law and constitution is decided upon by a foreign body not subject to our judiciary. And there's the other aspect of our challenge, too, that is a bit more difficult for people to try to grasp their mind around. We also say that it is unconstitutional for our Parliament even to grant a fictitious foreign non-entity domestic rights and international rights which trump the rights of legislatures and statutes. This was tried from 1608 to 1970. In 1608, Lord Cook, they tried it in a case called Sutton's Hospital. The English court said you can't give a corporation existence out of domestic country from where it's created. And they tried it all the way off and on. Adam Smith said this was a crazy idea. In the World Court in 1970, the World Court rejected this argument that a corporation can exert existence in more than one jurisdiction, the jurisdiction where it's created. And so what you have, you see it, what you have is you have these new, this new royalty of multinational corporations governing. And you get the result. And they have a Panamanian bank account, and you see the result of the system. And people and constitutions around the world are supposed to take a back seat to this. This is insane.
I might add, if we don't crush CETA, then we'll turn around twice and we'll be faced with the Trans-Pacific Partnership,
right,
which is even worse and presumably has a bigger text.
And could you comment on other actions involving crown prerogative, like deploying troops abroad? You're
essentially arguing that even that is invalidated unless it gets prior or eventual approval by Parliament?
I've argued that in the perimeter fence case. Listen, everybody, you know, there's an old bad joke that a lot of lawyers, jurists, and law professors have only two operating parts, and I say that's partly true, but I like to talk out of my mouth because it's closer to my brain. Others like to talk from the other end. The executive does not have the constitutional authority, and I filed against Prime Minister Chrétien when this happened in Kosovo. The executive, contrary to what Professor Mendez says, does not have the unilateral constitutional right to send troops abroad. The sending of troops abroad and/or the use of the military in Canada, we also challenged it at the Gufferson Lake uprising in BC, are governed by the Emergencies Act, which is the new version of the War Measures Act. Under the law, all military excursions, whether they be domestic or international, have to be through the Emergencies Act. When you send troops abroad under the Emergencies Act, there has to be a parliamentary committee of all the parties in the House that oversees the operations 24/7, and then after the emergency is done with, has to issue a report to Parliament and report whether or not the use of force was justified. Now, of course, you know, laws in the Constitution are very inconvenient these days. So people think, oh, the Governor General is the Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, therefore the Governor General can do what he or she wants. No. And, you know, the prohibition against putting sending soldiers out on the streets the way they did in Gufferson Lake contravenes the English Bill of Rights, which is still part of our Constitution, that you cannot, in peacetime, quarter an army and use an army on your own people. It's unconstitutional. The fact that these things happen and the fact that they're not challenged or that the courts haven't adjudicated doesn't mean that they're legal. And so Professor Mendez is wrong on that point, drawing that analogy on that point. The other thing I'd like to say is, and we make this clear in the statement of claim, is that if you look at treaties that stem from the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal government, when a treaty is signed by the federal government where it's the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal government, like, for instance, criminal law, those treaties are only signed pursuant to acts of Parliament. For instance, extradition treaties have to comply with the Extradition Act. The mutual assistance for taking of evidence and executing search warrants is similar. There's an act there. The return of children when they're kidnapped by one of the parents under a family law dispute, there's a Hague Convention for the return of children. Now, the federal government signed that, but it's funny, it's the exclusive jurisdiction of the province. It has no force in Canada unless the provincial parliaments pass it under their family law legislation. Ontario has passed it, but because it's the exclusive jurisdiction of the province, custody and access, it has to see approval and enactment by the province. With trade deals, they don't do this because it's inconvenient. They know very well that they're trampling and stomping on jurisdiction that's not theirs. So they fall back on this quaint right of divine rule that goes back to Versailles and Napoleon as their basis, literally. Residual crown prerogative. Well, just try to break that down. It said, what that means is we can rule over provincial and federal parliaments at whim. Well, where do we see this before? Certainly not in any modern post-1867 constitutional framework. So we're literally regressing to the notion that they can simply govern by fiat. Royal fiat at that. When our monarch says, you're on your own in 1982, I have nothing left to say in Canada. So analyze that.
And on that on the issue of encroaching on exclusive jurisdiction, I mean, like, there's been several lawsuits already under NAFTA, and like one, of course, just one example, Quebec banning of fracking,
right?
And that's being challenged. I mean, I'm wondering, based on what you're saying, one could just argue that Quebec could just comfortably ignore this. I mean, even if you're signed on to these agreements, I mean, one could challenge the ability to, or challenge lawsuits on that basis going forward. No,
No. You're missing the point here, Michael. No, Quebec can tell any company get lost, and the feds don't have a say over it. If they say no fracking. Except that the company who wants to come in to frack had intended to make $250 million. So the lawsuit is not against Quebec. It's against the federal government and the taxpayers of Canada, who will have to pay that $250 million, because Canada, in not being able to force Quebec to comply with the treaty rights, is in breach of the treaty. You understand?
Mm-hmm. But CETA does apply to subnational levels of government.
You're wrong. It's in the Statement of Claim. Chapter 2... Chapter 2, Section 2, Sub 2, says that the federal government undertakes to ensure that the objectives and the enforcement of the treaty is implemented by all levels of government, including provincial and municipal. And I'm basically quoting almost verbatim. So the federal government is going out there and saying, I promise that everybody in Canada, including the provinces and the municipalities, will comply with the treaty, knowing full well they have, one, no business promising that because it's unconstitutional, and two, no way in enforcing that because it's unconstitutional.
On the behalf of Canadian Banker Former, I just want to ask a basic question for the general public that's out there who aren't very educated on this data and the effects that it can have on their lives if it's passed. So can you bring up maybe some solid bullet points on how it's going to directly affect their lives?
The government will no longer be, the provincial governments will no longer be able to, without penalty to the federal government, give subsidies for health care, education, all the social programs that you see municipally in terms of, you know, community programs, mm-hmm. welfare, and all of that. Okay? If they do so, then the federal government, if it breaches a right, will have to pay. So how does the federal government avoid paying because the provinces won't let them do it? Well, behind the scenes, the federal government will use their spending power to say to the provinces, look, if you don't play ball on this, we'll cut our transfer payments to you for education and health. That's been how they've been able to implement the NAFTA when it's encroaching on provincial rights. So expect exorbitant utility bills, hydro, you've already seen them.
Mm-hmm.
Expect a cutting of educational program, a cutting of health benefits, on and on and on. So education, health, social programs, roads too, because private corporations will be able to compete with the government. It used to be that the government built highways. Now they're going to come in and privatize the roads, bridges, on and on.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.